This week on Piled High and Deep, the podcast, we have another one of those not quite traditional stories to the PhD. Well, Sheila Schroeder is a filmmaker, but she didn't start out that way. She did her undergrad thing and, like so many of us, headed off to corporate America. Well, she spent a couple of years there, but just wasn't feeling fulfilled. Something was missing.
I think the thing that motivated me most was that I wanted to teach. I felt like that was a great environment for me because it fed both my desire to help people, especially young people, and my desire to keep learning. Not that I couldn't do those things in other areas, but it seemed to me that teaching was the best way to mix those two things.
Now, Sheila had been making corporate communication films, and she really had it pretty good. But it wasn't until grad school, as she was working on a documentary about nuns in Indiana. Bear with me, it's a good story. But that's when she had her aha moment.
And you could see the bugs backlit with the sun rising on the horizon. And then you look off, and there's the steeple of the nunnery there in Oldenburg, Indiana. And I thought, this is what I want to do. So the teaching has become an integral part of my work as a filmmaker.
There's also the discussion about the dissertation, which was really actually fascinating. Sheila got a chance to go back to her Indiana round ball roots, and I won't give you any spoilers. It's interesting. Piled High and Deep, the podcast, is a production of Mountain Geek Productions. That's me, Ted Conte Jr. Please check out my website at themountaingeek.net, also on Twitter at themountaingeek, and Piled High and Deep, the podcast, has its own Twitter handle at phdpodcast. This was a lot of fun. I want to thank my brother-in-law, Merle Glyforst, for setting us up. Merle recently went through the University of Denver's filmmaking program, and Sheila was one of his instructors. And so Merle put the two of us together and had quite the fun chat. And actually, this is a little bit of a test because I want to try and stay up on that every other Wednesday release schedule. I just recorded this. I guess I left Sheila's house about, 5 hours ago. I guess it all depends on how much time I'm going to take editing now. So here we go. Let's start shoveling with Sheila Schroeder. Sheila, thank you very much for inviting me to your home. This is great. As we're talking about your PhD adventure, the University of Indiana to Denver, that's going to be a fun conversation. And I want to also say thanks to my brother-in-law, Merle Glyforst, for hooking the two of us up. Really appreciate his assistance. As I've really found in this whole process, I've only had one guest that actually resulted in another guest that I've been able to reach out to blindly that they've agreed to be on the show. So thank you very much.
Sure,
appreciate
it's
it.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it. The first thing I would kind of want to ask you is, what do you think the state of PhDs is today? As you see it in the academic environment, do you see young kids with all this knowledge being stuffed into their brains still interested in getting PhDs?
I do, although the market, the job market in several fields has really become saturated. And so it's exceptionally hard these days compared to when I came out a little over 20 years ago to find a tenure track position. So a number of things, the flooded job market and universities that are going to a structure that's different than, again, what I came into, which is, a tenure track position. You're there 7 years or 6 years, you move up or you move out. So a lot of universities are doing more teaching professors that have a different model that isn't necessarily tenure, could be tenure, could not be tenure. DU is one of those schools that has some hybrid positions where you could be a teaching professor, you teach more, but then your responsibilities are less in the creative work or scholarship.
What do you prefer?
I'm a creative artist, so I make films, and I really started the other way. I was trying to publish and create scholarship, but my sort of natural inclination and my abilities led me more into filmmaking.
So tell me, what's your title now? What is it that you do? You mentioned the University of Denver. Let's start there. Sure. And then we'll bounce around as this conversation tends to go.
Sure. So my title is Associate Professor. I got tenure, I'm trying to think how many years ago.
A long time ago.
Yeah, I think it was about 8 years ago. I actually started there as a lecturer. So I came out of Indiana University, ABD, all but dissertation. I worked here for 2 years. In 99, I received my PhD, but I came in as a lecturer. So that was a full-time teaching position, taught 6 classes a year. We're on the quarter system. And then after 6 years of doing that, I was promoted to a tenure-track position. I was in that tenure-track position then, I think 6 years, was promoted to associate professor, and now I'm on my way, hopefully, knock on wood, to full professor.
What led you down? It's media and communications is the department you're in. What led you to going that academic route rather than going down the pure creative route?
That story takes us way back.
Well, right? So we're gonna and we'll touch on that.
Sure.
But as you sit here now, and it kind of goes back to what we just talked about, kids who are choosing, this continuation of their academic life mm-hmm. to the PhD or going into, to making stuff. What made you take the other fork rather than that fork?
I think the thing that motivated me most was that I wanted to teach. I felt like that was a great environment for me because it fed both my desire to help people, especially young people, and my desire to keep learning. Not that I couldn't do those things in other areas, but it seemed to me that teaching was the best way to mix those two things. So that's what I chose.
From the creative standpoint, do you find it challenging to balance the need to create and to teach at the same time, or are you able to mix those two together?
I'm super lucky because one of the things that being in academe affords me to do is to create and within a sort of umbrella. So I know a lot of my friends who are working, but they want to be filmmakers, and so they have to cobble together the equipment and the people and all of those resources that you need to make films, in my case. And I'm very fortunate in that I can walk into our equipment cage and say, okay, I need a camera, I need a tripod, I need a mic, I need all the tools, right? And so that is very fortunate. On the other hand, though, I have a full-time job of teaching, and I have a full-time job of being a creative artist, and I have a full-time job servicing the department, the university, and my profession. So when people ask me, you only teach 2 days a week, and combined, 4 hours each of those days. And then when you add on the fact that being a creative artist is part of my job, and certainly the service component is extraordinarily important in academe, where you're advising students, you're serving on committees, you're on a hiring, additional colleagues, the university is in the strategic planning mode, and you're on a committee to help form that strategic plan. All those different things. You're reviewing grants. You're doing tenure cases for people across the country. You're an outside reviewer doing those things. So I think what gets hidden in academe are all those commitments that you have in each of those areas: teaching, creative, in my case, creative work or scholarship, and service.
Where did this path begin? Indiana?
Yeah.
Did it start in Indiana?
Sure did. My undergrad is from a smaller school, Valparaiso University. Being a basketball fan, you yep. probably have heard of Valparaiso.
Absolutely.
Of course, I grew up playing basketball myself, but I went to a small liberal arts school and wanted to do education and journalism, a double major. And when I found out that I'd probably have to go to school an extra year, that just seemed impossible in the moment, you know, 5 years instead of four. And it wasn't until I was a junior in college that I understood the difference between an MD and a PhD. And it sounds ridiculous now, but that was the kind of environment that I grew up in, a very working class, blue collar family.
Did your parents have college degrees?
They did not. I was the first to go to a 4-year college in my family and my extended family. And so somehow I surrounded myself with all these brainiacs. So I had, chemistry and biology and English, all these folks went on for advanced degrees. And so as juniors, they were looking at PhD institutions in chemistry and veterinary medicine in English literature. And I was like, go to school more? Are you kidding me? All I wanted to do was get out and get a job, because that was my family orientation. That was my orientation. And thank goodness I had these amazing women around me who showed me the way, like why a PhD might be important and what kind of careers that would open. So I decided not to do the double major, because that extra year, I just couldn't fathom that. But I did certainly keep file that in the back of my mind. And so I worked for about 5 years in corporate media. And while I was having a successful career and enjoyed what I was doing, there was that little part of me that said, I think teaching should be the way to go. And when I think back on it now, I don't quite understand why that particular moment, but I'm really glad of the path, because I do enjoy the lifestyle. I relish the opportunities in the classroom. I can't imagine how lucky I am to be making films again under the umbrella, where I don't have to scrounge and scavenge and, really try to find resources. I'm very blessed in that way.
So I want to back up.
Sure.
Blue collar family, small Indiana town. Was there an expectation from mom and dad that you were going to escape and you were going to have it better than us, type of thing?
Oh, sure. I mean, they were, to my parents' credit, even though they were not very educated, and they had somewhat of a bias against education. And I'm not saying they didn't want me to go to college, but I think because of their own limitations with education, they didn't necessarily see the value in going beyond 4 years of... I mean, they were super proud of me for getting a college degree and just being in college. I mean, they certainly recognized that, but... And frankly, to their, I can still picture us in the booth at Greek's Pizzeria when I said to them, I'm gonna quit my job where I've been very successful, worked my way up, and I'm gonna go back to school and I'm gonna become a teacher. And they sort of looked at me like, well, what's a master's degree? And so I explained that it'd be 2 more years of college. And they basically said, well, we don't quite understand it, but go for it. So I'm, again, very fortunate to have parents who, while they might not have fully understood, they certainly supported.
How did you decide? I want to go first to the Valpo decision mm-hmm. from high school. Was that just because it was close by?
No. In fact, I would have preferred, I think, to go somewhere out of town. But Valpo gave me the best financial aid deal. And again, as a student from a working class family, I was concerned about how I was going to pay for things. And I, except for the first year where my parents helped cover my meals, it was all on me. And so I received a really good financial aid package from Valparaiso. And so I decided to stay in town. Now, the interesting thing was, even though the university's, you know, right in town and I'd been by there 1,000 times, the university was really like a separate entity. I was very much into high school and sports and the yearbook and all that sort of thing. So I didn't spend much time on campus. So it was like going away, even though, you know, my I could stop at home and do my laundry, right? Which is the cliche, but it certainly was true in my case.
Was there a turning point for you to make that decision that I'm done with, I'm done with the corporate life? What was that decision path for you?
Yeah, let me think about it. I mean, I know that I had, you know, held on to this desire to be a teacher, and even though my corporate job was doing well, I had made a poor hire, and I hired somebody who was intolerable to work with, and I thought I either have to get a new job or I have to do something, because it doesn't seem like she's going anywhere. And I think those are good moments to have in our lives because they ask us the important questions of, you know, what's our life about? And, so it forced me to think about that. And I decided my life is about teaching. Now I still didn't fully understand that in order to teach at the college level, having a PhD is probably the end goal for me. I knew the MA was the first step, but I knew nothing about the MFA, which in my field of creative work, probably, if I think back on it now, probably would have been the better route for me. But I have to say that sometimes having the PhD after your name can be an advantage. And I don't say that in a snobby way or anything like that, but for some reason, there is some cachet in various circles having a PhD. And while it's not something I wave around on a flag, it is what it is, and for better or worse, right?
How did you find filmmaking? Because I did the high school newspaper. I did also the yearbook. My route went to radio from there, mm-hmm. Hence the reason why I got a podcast now. How did you find filmmaking? Did you find it in high school?
I started filmmaking in college as an undergrad. So I remember making a video about internships, I believe it was. And I remember, I have vague memories of like different scenes in that video that I did. And I really enjoyed it. And so when I got into corporate, I was taking a class at the time called writing a business plan or something like business communications. And our final project was to write a business plan. And so I was doing an internship at the company that eventually hired me. And so the business plan I wrote up for them was that they should resurrect their video department. Now, this is 1986, and this is when not a lot of corporate video existed. But they had a small department before I got there, and then I got there and did some things for them. And so I made this business plan, and I presented it to the president of the company, and he said, okay. Well, let's start you off at the handsome salary of $13,000 a year, and here's the department. Go for it. And I thought, oh my gosh, I just got myself a job. And so I sort of had to kind of reinvent kind of what they were going to be doing. And fortunately, I had a lot of leeway to do that. I'm not sure if that answers the question we were on, but it's a
no. I it doesn't matter because. At 21 or 22, fresh, green, out of college, you're essentially given the keys to the world.
Yeah, Yeah, I had a lot of freedom. And it was the great thing about jobs like that is that everything you do is like the first time and everybody loves it. And if I went back to some of those early videos, I wouldn't be happy.
Right.
Let's just put it this way. I wouldn't be broadcasting it on Facebook. A lot of those, you know, a lot of it was like some corporate training. We used to do something called, it was like a postcard show, and in which we would, it was a corporation that had a lot of franchisees. And so we would do a half hour to an hour show of trainings, of updates, of, you know, it was like a news program. And with some different training segments and that sort of thing. It was a lot of fun, and I got to be really creative with it, and they, of course, loved it. All on VHS tape, which was awesome. So when you're working in that environment, you take advantage of the opportunity and you go for it. I also got a chance to design and build a studio. So they had a period of growth and they said, okay, we need to get you out of this back room and get you your own studio. So I got to do that. I mean, I just had some incredible opportunities.
The opportunity to fail at such a young age and not to be hampered by it, to be encouraged. I mean, that's almost like you're being told, you're being given permission to fail on a daily basis. Yeah.
Well, and they didn't see it that way. I mean, they obviously saw it as an opportunity to succeed. But I'm of the mind, right, that fail fast.
Yeah.
And do something else. You know, try this thing. If it doesn't work, try something else.
That's exactly my Absolutely. Point, is that so often, and in the industry, I just the sense that I get today is that kids are so afraid to fail. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I just see it in young people that come through offices that I've worked at, is they want to make sure that they're doing it right the very first time, mm-hmm. rather than taking an opportunity to learn a path
of exploration. Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up, because having just shot a narrative film a few weeks ago, we wrapped shooting on a new short film called Scary Lucy that you may know about. And one of my takeaways from that is that the whole program is about having alumni mentor students, and together we make a film. And there are more components to that. Maybe we'll get into it. But what I often see is that idea that I have to do this perfectly the first time out. And I think what I try to model for them is that, wow, I just made that mistake. How am I going to fix it? Or we have a challenge in front of us, right? A problem. Something happened that was unexpected, that could impact what we're trying to do. I'm not going to look backwards and figure out who to blame. I'm going to look forward and say, okay, well, here's the problem that we're presented with. How can we fix it? That's me as a producer, right? And that's what I tell my students, is the best filmmaker is the one who knows how to troubleshoot.
I'm going to personalize this a little bit. When I started this podcast back in February and March, I decided that early on, these aren't going to be perfect. In fact, none of these will be perfect.
Exactly, yeah.
And if I try to make them perfect, I'll never get anything out the door.
Yeah.
I like to write. I have dreams of someday, maybe this can be enough to make me a living and support my family, et cetera. And I'm also a writer. Same idea. I want to, you know, maybe I can get out of the insurance industry and support myself with podcasts and writing. And my mom, when I first started writing, gave me a t-shirt that says, even if it's crap, put it on the page.
Mm-hmm. That's great advice.
Because we can always edit it out.
Yes.
And it doesn't matter if, by sharing the learning process, with the world makes helps you grow and become more comfortable with what it is. Okay, so I'm getting off track here. How did you, in talking to Merle, my brother-in-law again, it's my understanding that for the most part, you're a documentary filmmaker. Is that correct?
That's how I started.
Okay.
And I can pinpoint the moment, my filmmaking sort of turning point to a field in Oldenburg, Indiana at about 4:30 a.m. I was working with a colleague at Indiana University. She was working on a piece for PBS, WTIU, Bloomington, and it was about nuns who were organic farmers. And the alarm went off at about 3:30, and she's like, she was the producer, right? I was just shooting for her. I was a cinematographer. And she's like, I don't want to. And I'm like, come on, let's go. And so here I find myself at dawn in the middle of summer in the middle of a cornfield. And the mist is coming up off the corn. And you could see the bugs backlit with the sun rising on the horizon. And then you look off, and there's the steeple of the nunnery there in Oldenburg, Indiana. And I thought, this is what I want to do. So the teaching has become an integral part of my work as a filmmaker. And so I started off in documentary. We worked on that film together. We worked on another film about a utopian community in Indiana that wasn't so utopian, as it turns out, also in graduate school, along with some other pieces. And so when I came to DU, my orientation was definitely documentary. So I worked on, I think, five different documentaries, features, as well as shorts. And then my career took a little bit of a turn when a story came to me that turned out to be Happy Effing Valentine's Day. And then Scary Lucy, another short comedy, came to me as a script. And so I feel, and I teach both, I teach narrative, I teach documentary. I love them both. And if you asked me my favorite, I couldn't tell you.
How did you end up, so you're working this corporate gig, I'm guessing it's in Bloomington, or is it in Indianapolis or Chicago?
It's Merrillville, which is between Valparaiso and Chicago.
Okay, so you have this turning point of going, all right, I'm going to be a teacher. How do you end up at the University of Indiana? Was it just close by?
Indiana University had a great department. At the time, it was called telecommunications. I don't know why. That's a traditional name. It came out of the telephone industry, right? I was drawn to Bloomington itself. I was drawn to the department and the strong people that they had. And frankly, I didn't know what the hell I was doing as a student looking for graduate programs. I mean, I made a couple of visits, and again, it came down to cashola, and Indiana University gave me a better deal than Michigan State, and that's where I went. So a lot of my decisions have been dictated by my financial aid package, but frankly, it turned out to be a great decision. I loved my years in Bloomington. So I was there for 2 years as a master's student. I left after my master's, went back to Valparaiso, and I taught for 2 years. And then I returned to Bloomington for my PhD.
What was the focus for that master's?
So the master's, my master's thesis was on technology, culture, and the advent of night baseball. So the changes that the culture was experiencing and how night baseball became both a reflection of and a catalyst for change in the 1930s.
That's
you so it's a cultural history,
yeah, right.
Basically.
Okay, so I'm sensing something here real quick, and we may end up bouncing around here. You said you played baseball or basketball.
Yep.
You're putting a focus on baseball now.
Mm-hmm.
Sports plays a big impact in your life?
It does, yeah, and it has always had that impact. And then, my PhD, my dissertation was on the WNBA and the ABL, the American Basketball League, which predated the WNBA, two women's professional basketball leagues starting right after the Olympics, right around the Olympic time, and the sort of discourse of femininity at, you know, during that period of time. So the work that I do, or the work that I did as a scholar, really brought in my interest in sports and my interest in gender, women's studies, the dominant discourse of cultural history. And frankly, I was a huge Cubs fan, and night baseball came to Wrigley Field, I believe, in 1988, which was right that period of time when I was living in Northwest Indiana. I was able to scrounge up a few bucks and go to Wrigley Field. I remember one particular day of, it was Women's Day at Wrigley Field, and my friends and I got to go down on the field and, you know, take a knee in center field and listen to some coach pontificate about something when all we wanted to do was run around and play catch.
Right. What sports did you play as a kid? Was it just basketball? Or did you play softball, baseball?
I played pretty much everything. So I played softball, tennis. I was on the track and field team for a couple of years. I was a volleyball player and a basketball player. But, you know, the big sport for me was basketball for sure.
I'm going to digress here real quick. I was talking to a fella a couple of weeks ago. I was at a gathering, and he's a general in the United States Air Force Reserves. Mm-hmm. Super bright guy. I mean, he's an airline pilot. He went down at the Air Force Academy. I can't give more details than where he's at. I don't want, because sure, people will figure it out. He told me something really interesting, and give me a second here as I get sure to the point. He told me that studies done by the military show that the greatest indicator of success for a officer in the military is not sports, is not academics, it's marching band participation.
Mm.
The point of my question is, with all the work that, with all your time in sports, and the WNBA, I'm a big fan of women's basketball. I work for the University of Colorado women's basketball public address announcer. I guess my point is, and I'm getting there. Is there a difference when it comes to that team? Boy, I'm really going around it here. I'm fascinated by women's sports and my perception that there's more teamwork in women's sports than there are in men's sports. Boy, this interview's really gone to heck. But I think also that other part of it is from film. I mean, filmmaking is a team concept as well.
Yes and no. So I think this is an important point that you're bringing up. Certainly an important point to me as a filmmaker, as an educator. So when I started making my films, it was pretty much me, a camera, right? And I was shooting, I was editing, I was doing sound, and these were the days before color correction. It was a one-person band. And I was successfully making films, I was enjoying myself, but the part that I missed the most was the teamwork. And as a point guard, you know, you're there, you're directing traffic, but you revel in the success of the team and in others. I hand the ball off to you, you score, we high five when we're going down the court. That was my happy place. And so when I started off doing independent documentary film, there was some big part that was missing. And when we came up with the story for Happy Effing Valentine's Day, I thought, there's no way I can make this film by myself. How do I make this? How do I bring a team together? And I thought, the only people who can do that are those alums that have the experience. And how can I make this an educational experience? Oh, I can bring my students into this too. And we can mentor each other. And I built the team, right? It's the team. It's that basketball team I was on in high school and college and enjoyed so much. It's those relationships that you have that you learn together, and you're in the thick of things, and you're down in the trenches, and you're trying to figure a way, like, how are we going to score this point, or how are we going to get this shot? And that is exactly what why I have gravitated toward narrative filmmaking, because I love working with people who add to the project, and it's not just all on my shoulders, where I can collaborate with people. That is my joy.
I don't know. It certainly seems like at the tail end of the Ken Burns documentary on the Vietnam War, that looks like it's a pretty intense team effort.
No question. And Ken Burns makes films that are completely different.
Right, I know.
On a different scale than I was making my my documentaries. See What I Got, a story of girls basketball, Confidence and Courage, was my first feature documentary, and I got to go to Europe and follow this team of girls coming together, learning how to collaborate, learning how to build confidence in themselves and in through each other. And it was a great experience being that close to a team again, but pretty much the documentary was a one person kind of show where I spent a heck of a lot of time and hours not only following these girls for a year, but then also taking about a year and a half to edit the project.
I want to back up, bouncing around. Welcome to my brain. Did you find the satisfaction you were looking for in teaching at Valpo when you went back after your master's?
Absolutely. That's why I went back for my PhD.
Right.
Yeah, I decided this is going to be the career. And part of those 2 years was trying to figure out, well, what could I study in my PhD that where I could spend years of my life doing, and that would connect somehow to my passions, which in that case were sports. And I was able to come up with this idea around the ABL and the WNBA. And so I was able to marry those two things together. And that's ultimately why, one of the reasons why I went back for the PhD. The other reason was I had so enjoyed my time at Valpo and decided that teaching was going to be my career. And so in order to do that, full time, at the level that I wanted to do it, a PhD was my only option at the time.
How did you find going back then? So you returned to Indiana. How did you find that atmosphere, or did you find the same chutzpah? That's not quite the word I'm looking for. Did you find enjoying it as much coming back after the master's? Were you able to dig right back in and back to where you started?
I pretty much picked up where I left off. I mean, the faculty had changed a little bit, and the department itself was going through some transitions. And at times, students were kind of caught in the middle, but I think my advisor especially did a really good job of sort of keeping me out of the fray. I did have some positions of leadership among the graduate students, and so I was able to navigate. I wasn't as invested, certainly, as a lot of the faculty members in some of the philosophical debates. So it wasn't that difficult, but there was a splintering going on that caused some consternation for some students, and certainly for faculty members who had their differences.
Was that a program before you'd call it telecommunications? Mm-hmm. Had they made the change then to being a more traditional journalism school then, or a filmmaking school? What did you walk into at that point, and how did it progress?
Yeah, at Indiana, they had a long tradition of journalism, and journalism was its own entity. So I believe at the time it was a school. And then in telecommunications, they had the communication and culture kind of degree, which was where I sort of landed most. Then they had more of a kind of social science statistical sort of, you know, so it was divided between methodologies, qualitative versus quantitative, and there were some philosophical differences there too. And the change in departments didn't actually happen until I left. They were, I remember being at a ceremony. They were breaking ground for an addition to our existing building. And I was asked to speak at this event. And I remember specifically talking about how that how there might be some differences. And yet the thing that always sort of brings us together were are these this vast media that we all study, and that this whole idea that there are more things that bring us together than tear us apart. So I was sort of pleading for some unity at the time, which I think was a good message that some of my faculty, some of the faculty there needed to hear.
Did you ever view, was it more of a function of you being familiar with Indiana? Is that why you went down that path to get your PhD rather than taking a look at other options? Because it does sound like, I mean, there are other schools out there that have documentary film programs, et cetera. Was it, again, the function of money and you already had the relationships?
Part of it was definitely that I had the relationships. It was familiar. And again, kind of being a small town kid at the time, that had a real appeal. You know, I didn't have to go and explore a whole new territory and find where to live, right? I kind of knew it. I had some built-in friends who were there, so that was nice. But knowing what I know now, again, like, would the MFA have been a better route for me? Would going to California and going to a school out there have been a better choice? It's hard to say at this point, and certainly I'm not going to second guess those kind of yeah. choices. But yes, I think one of the things, one of the pieces that was missing from my life, again, were like these parents who might have said, "Hey, go out and explore the world." That wasn't necessarily the family that I was from, so I didn't have that kind of guidance. So the familiar felt pretty good at that time when I was taking on something that I didn't even know that I could do at the time.
I think that it's probably paid off, though, well for you, because where you're at have all these MFA backgrounds, probably. And since you came in kind of the back door route, what does it add to maybe the group of scholars that you're working with when you do have opportunities to collaborate and build the program that you're looking to build with your fellow professors?
Yeah, I think at this point, people look more at the body of work than they do necessarily the letters after my name. And for me, that's great. It's a privilege of being in academia for so long. I mean, I've been teaching probably 30 years now. I mean, 21 at DU and then teaching throughout my graduate career. So you know, but like I said before, having a PhD generally doesn't hurt me.
Right.
For some reason, people associate that with people who are smarter or whatever. And I always say it's perseverance. I'm not smarter than, you know, the person I'm sitting next to on the bus. And I'm not saying I have more perseverance than them necessarily, but I was able to sort of make it through, finish the dissertation, get the degree, wear the funny hat, and here I sit today.
I want to talk about that dissertation, because how is it different than the dissertations that I've run into of the 13 previous people that I've talked with? Those have been, scientists, where they have hard data. I've had a guy who has his PhD in a couple of PhDs in English. So those are taking a look at texts and books and coming up with their theories, their dissertations. You're a filmmaker. Is your dissertation your final film?
No, in this case, my dissertation was a scholarly work, research based on the advent and ultimate demise of the ABL and the advent of the WNBA. So as I was finishing my dissertation, the ABL, the American Basketball League, folded. So right in December, right before I'm handing in my final version to my advisor, the ABL announces we are not going to be a league anymore. And I was like, Chris, what do I do? He said, well, you predicted that this was going to happen. So in your conclusion, you just have to acknowledge that, unfortunately, the signs that you were seeing all came to fruition. And the crystal ball that you were looking in was very clear. And that's your final chapter. So
there wasn't a film that came out of that.
No. In this, so the filmmaking has come since, even though as a grad student, I was making films at IU. I was doing them as part of either my teaching responsibility, or I was a TA for the television station on campus. And so I was doing films as in collaboration. I was teaching television, and documentary filmmaking and things like that. I was either teaching those classes by myself or assisting in those classes. And so so as a teacher, I was learning those skills, those production skills, those critical skills on how to analyze and create media that has meaning to it. And then in the PhD, I was doing scholarly research. I was looking at a cultural history of both of these leagues and trying to determine what it was, how they were sort of developing. And essentially, I saw a couple of differences. One, and this takes me back, so you're asking
no,
me.
No, that's fine.
21 years. Yeah. But essentially, from what I remember, the WNBA was using more of a discourse of femininity. So how are these basketball players also women? Whereas the ABL was promoting itself as female athletes, just pure and simple. And so those were two distinct differences in these leagues. And so I looked at advertising. I looked at their marketing materials. I talked to people who started the ABL. I went out to California. I visited with Tara Vanderveer at Stanford, who was a proponent of the WNBA at the time. She was doing some commenting. It was one of the thrills of my graduate career, Tara Vanderveer being the coach of the Stanford women's basketball team and the Olympic coach at the time. So I got to do kind of all of those kind of things and analyzing this kind of critical moment in women's sports history.
What's the brand? What's then the trigger for you to come to DU and into that? Because the program you're in again, or you teach in the multimedia communications.
Media, film, and journalism. Media, film, and studies journalism. Department.
Okay.
Yeah.
All righty. So, what's the trigger then for you to come to DU?
Yeah. So this kind of goes back to one of those first questions you asked about, you know, what's the environment like. So back in 1997, when I was coming out try to find a job, I had I had like 6 different interviews. I went for actual jobs that were open, mostly tenure track jobs. And so I traveled to Boston and Gunnison, Colorado. And
Western State.
Yes, Western State. And I had an interview here at Denver. And the position here was a lecturer. So coming from a D1, Division I research institution, my colleagues sort of look down on the idea that I would come out and take a lecturer position, but it was Denver. And I had been out to Denver to visit my brothers who had lived out here at various times. They didn't live out here then, but I had fallen in love with Denver. And when I was imagining myself in a job, I, you know, when I closed my eyes, I thought, I think Denver would be the place. and be careful what you wish for, right? I mean, I got so lucky. And but it was a lecture. And so I was like, well, if they offer me the job, I will go, because the job is more important than some sort of label or title. And it was teaching production, which is what I was training to do as a teacher. And I fell in love with Denver, and I'm still in love.
So the production part, you're essentially self-taught on the production part of it.
Pretty much, yeah.
The educating part, you're more of a that followed more of the traditional track.
Yes. Yeah. In terms of a scholar.
Right.
Absolutely, yeah.
How much of your time do you spend today between those two? Do you teach classes in purely production, or do you get to go down that path of talking about social and cultural issues within media, et cetera?
Well, the way that we teach production at DU is that we combine theory, history, ethics, and practice. So, for instance, in the introduction to field production and editing class, it's an introduction to camera, sound, lighting, editing, and the pre-production process. So imagine doing that in 10 weeks. But I get to also talk about the sort of critical lens that we apply to, well, why do we shoot this shot from up above somebody? How does that make us feel as an audience toward this character that we're looking down on? And so we're talking about, we're bringing in some of the theoretical elements of production, some of the critical. So I don't want a student just to learn how to turn on buttons. I want them to understand why you use a particular lens, why is shallow depth of field more important for this particular moment than wide depth of field. So it's a combination of those things.
What is a kid who comes out of DU, where do they go?
We have had students go everywhere from the spectrum, from writing on first class shows in LA, like Orange is the New Black, Narcos, the Mars, Ron Howard's Mars program, to students who are starting their own video production companies here in Denver, to everything in between. So we've had students in New York, some students travel the world doing videography. They're storytellers. They are editors. And editors are storytellers, of course, but they're producers, they're cinematographers, they're writers, they're and everything in between. So we don't have sort of one funnel going in one particular place. We have students who, you know, have a passion for editing, so they become a freelance editor, and then they have stepping stones, and then they find themselves editing trailers in LA. So you just it's a broad spectrum.
When somebody's looking at a career down this path, 18-year-old, 19-year-old kids coming to you, maybe they're taking this class, you know, I remember taking not silly classes, but, you know, as a freshman in college, you know, yeah, I would have taken this class. What are you finding that they're interested in?
Well, I'm lucky because I teach in a major that where students really have a passion, so I don't have to sort of...
You don't have to sell them on it.
I don't. I can feed the passion and nurture the passion, but usually they come to me with some real interest in what we're doing. And I think the thing that I've found, especially in the last 10 years or so, that I've gotten better at is creating the team, right? Expressing to them how important the team is to the process and how they can contribute to it and how they can feed off of their collaborators.
Would 19-year-old Sheila be happy with where Sheila is now?
53, thank you. I think so. I mean, I think I think she might want me to have a little better golf game, but other than that, I think she'd be pretty happy.
Did Sheila
happy.
Back at 19 know what golf even was?
You know, I wish she had. I wish it, Sheila at 10 years old knew what golf was, because I think that could have been her thing. She was a decent basketball player and an okay volleyball player and all those other things, but I think she could have been an exceptional golfer.
Well, it's certainly a lot more opportunities for college scholarships that way. I do want to touch on one other thing here, real quick. Let's talk about athletics and the role that it plays in the college environment. Interesting story coming out today about some challenges that the NCAA is suddenly going to be facing the last couple of days with the allegations of impropriety and bribery against some basketball coach. I don't know if you...
I haven't heard of that today, but it's an ongoing discourse, right?
It is, absolutely.
Yeah.
But I do want to talk about, you know, we're hearing these terms of student-athlete. Is college athletics still a viable path?
This is a big question.
It's a huge question.
Yeah.
Shut me down if you want.
Yeah.
But I think I still think it's an important question that we have to ask, because, you know, sitting here as middle class white guy who's, you know, looking at his children going to college and I'm going to be able to pay for it. Is it still reasonable to expect that as a path for kids who don't have those advantages my kids have?
Right.
That athletic path?
Yeah. I mean,
I know that we're totally off base.
That's fine. Yeah. I was listening to talk sports radio yesterday, and, you know, one of the broadcasters said, well, we can stop all this stuff if we just pay the student athletes. And that might solve some of the corruption that happens, that we all know happens. But I also think I have trouble with just sort of throwing money at a problem. So, for instance, there are leagues out there that have created stepping stones, baseball being one of those that has multiple levels. So if a kid wants to, a male, right? This is all for boys.
Absolutely,
mostly.
It is, yes.
But if they want to follow a path where they're getting paid, then they go into single A ball or whatever and try to work themselves into a multi-million dollar contract,
right,
which we know is like winning the lottery. And does football need to go to that model, and that we allow those superstar athletes to shine in the minor leagues, and we still have a version of that in college because we still have college baseball, right? It seems to me then that creates more opportunities, especially for students who are from socioeconomic levels that demand the 19-year-old go out and get a job. So I'm all for that. And then we employ more people down the line, right? We have stadium concessions,
right,
and we build an economy around those kinds of things. And it surprises me that no one has done that. Because it seems to me that we've seen that as a viable economic model in something like baseball and the D League in basketball and soccer leagues.
Well, I think absolutely. Like all you have to do is take a look at the way that soccer works over in Europe, and you have multiple, they're not minor league teams, but they're lower division,
but
who are not as good.
Them.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, but I think, I guess it's one of those things where at the end of a Saturday evening, when I've been sitting on my couch for 4 or 5 hours watching college football during the fall and winter, or watching basketball and, you know, March Madness, there's that icky feeling that I have that I've been sitting down, cheering for these, you know, enjoying watching these mm-hmm. kids who at the end of the day, are they, what's the value of what they're getting for what they're putting in?
Well, I had, I mean, I can't remember the direct total, but I had probably close to $50,000 in student debt when I left after my PhD. That was, you know, undergrad through graduate school. And I found that to be a very burdensome sort of
absolutely yep
adventure, but it got me to where I needed to go, and that's what it cost, and that's what I was willing to put in, and the sacrifices I've made since graduating. Whereas a student athlete on a full ride walks out of ideally a 4-year education with no student debt. So I think what this debate does is it undervalues education. So it just says, well, that student athlete is only there to play basketball, so why are we pretending? Well, why don't we look at it another way? Is they're actually there to get an education.
That's the idea, yes.
Right. And if we put more emphasis on the education, because we know that less than 1% of those student athletes are actually going to make a living in the sport that they're participating in, I think our priorities are out of whack. And that's not just me, the educator, talking. That's me, the critical citizen, talking about how do we make sustainable careers for our students and our student athletes, because so few of them are actually going to be participating in their sports.
And I think that you talk about the $50,000 that you had to go to get through your PhD. I had about 16 or 17 after an undergrad. Mm-hmm. I'm taking a look at what kids are doing today. You know, just the regular college student. Let's not talk. Oh, you know, not the athlete.
Insane.
The amount of money to get an undergrad degree, and the expectations that we then have as we're pushing them out the door and to become functioning, capable citizens of the world. The conversation's way too big for just here. We could start a whole new podcast with it. But I guess at the end of the day, when I ask you, was your PhD worth it? I'm hearing yes.
Absolutely. I have a blessed life. For instance, as I sit here before you, I'm on sabbatical for a year. Now I've taken a pay cut. My pay is cut in half because I'm going to take the whole year. And I've been saving for 7 years in order to do this. But, you know, I have time to do the creative projects that I want to do. I have time to take a walk in the morning if I'd like. I have time to change the pace of my life this year. And I don't know of many corporate opportunities that afford those kinds of moments of self-reflection, self-work, advancing your career through study, through learning. It's a wonderful life, and I couldn't recommend it more. And frankly, that's just a small part of it, right? The best part is the interaction that I have with young people and the opportunity to learn from them and to help them along that path as they figure out what their passions are and where they're going to head. And one of the best parts of my job is keeping in touch with them afterwards and kind of seeing where they're headed and where they find themselves and the adventures that they have and the turmoil and the joys that they experience along the way.
Sheila, thank you very much. Thanks for piling it high and deep with us.
It's been my pleasure, Ted.
Thanks. Thank you again, Dr. Sheila Schroeder, Associate Professor in the Department of Media, Film, and Journalism Studies at the University of Denver, here in Denver, Colorado. Merle, my brother-in-law, thank you very much for the assist. Greatly appreciate it. I've had fun. This is a nice little experiment to see how quick I can turn around a podcast. I think I'm just about done. I'm going to finish bloviating here, and then I'll hit the mix button, and we'll see how long this takes to mix down and post on the website. If you're interested more about Sheila, I will also post a link on my website in the description. You should be able to click on that link in the description of whatever podcast app you're using to listen, and check out some of her great work. Well, that's it. We're done shoveling. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks.